Packet Pushers.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of Packet Protector, the podcast at the intersection of networking and security. I'm Jennifer JJ Manella, here with Drew Conry Murray. We're kicking off with some fantastic news. We have a big news roundup, lots of juicy stuff happening. And Drew, tell them what they've won this week.
Yeah, none of it's fantastic, but we are going to be talking about new research into vulnerabilities in LTE and 5G implementations, some supply chain concerns and a beyond trust attack, submarine cable shenanigans, a class action lawsuit against LinkedIn over alleged sharing of customer chats for the purpose of AI training models, and lots of patching for Juniper, Fortinet, SonicWall, Zycel, and Ivanti. So JJ, let's jump right into it. We'll start with LTE and 5G. Researchers from the University of Florida and North Carolina State University have identified 119 vulnerabilities in the core infrastructure of LTE and 5G implementations. They're saying the vulnerabilities could be exploited to disrupt services at a citywide level, often just by sending malformed packets.
Yeah, so I thought this was really interesting. I guess you guys, I feel like we don't really know our listeners sometimes and they don't know us very well because we try to keep the chit chat down to a minimum. But I'm in the Raleigh area in North Carolina, so NC State is here. They have a fantastic engineering school. I've actually spoken to over the past 2 or 3 years, several people from the research group that works on cellular technologies, and they do some really cool stuff. So this was something by them in University of Florida. And LTE, of course, is sort of the 4G-ish. So the one thing to know about cellular is 4G is not really 4G, which is why we call it LTE. And 5G that we have right now is not really pure 5G. And cellular systems are just so much more complex than, you know, what we're used to in other, you know, wireless. But I thought this research is really interesting. So I'm never surprised when I see different vulnerabilities found. 119 is a large number, but some of these were unauthenticated attacks, which means they could take a phone that did not even have a SIM card in it.
Right.
Send really small packets and not even have to be in the area, like the physical space of a tower. And they could cause a pretty widespread denial of service attack that they're claiming could be like municipal, citywide within a whole region.
Right. Yeah. Scary stuff.
Yeah. They also did some attacks from like femtocell repeater type of things that you might have in buildings or in homes. So there was a series of attacks from that. And I think they even launched some from an internet connected device through wireless calling. So pretty broad range of the sources of the attacks and the methods of the attacks out of these, you know, 120-ish that they hit.
Right, which means a malicious actor anywhere in the world could conceivably take out cell service, phone service, connectivity for a city thousands of miles away.
Yeah. And that's pretty scary. And again, LTE being kind of that more legacy 4G-ish technology, you know, our hopes with 5G is that we've abstracted and virtualized the technologies. Because if you look at like the cellular architecture, and I'm not a cellular specialist, you know, I know enough to be dangerous to do the private cellular stuff that we do. But there's lots of different servers and services. There's an authentication server and there's a broker service and then there's a forwarding server. Like there's all of these different, think of them as kind of servers or services running at different places. And we've kind of abstracted that out from the hardware now, which is a new way to do things. So I kind of expect through 2025, even 2026, probably through 2028, even getting into the next generation of whatever that cellular is going to be, that there's going to be a lot of conversation around vulnerabilities, a lot of research around this. You know, I think for so long, there have been pockets of researchers focused on cellular, but the equipment needed to really mess with that has been cost prohibitive, and now it's not.
Right. It's really expensive. A lot of it's proprietary. There's only a few vendors in the space. There have been efforts by the industry to sort of open it up. That's kind of open RAN movement, which, as you said, like it's becoming more software-based with a lot of services running essentially in virtual environments on off-the-shelf components, which on the one hand brings down costs, and that's a good thing, but also is probably exposing more vulnerabilities that were probably already always there, but now folks can actually start to get access to them, play around with them, and see what's happening. The researchers did put out a paper with a lot more detail on what they found, how they found it, how they're exploiting it. And we have the PDF link in the show notes if you want to check it out.
It's called RANSAT. What a fantastic name.
It's right there. They got it. Good for them.
Yeah, nailed that one. The other last kind of note on there with the cellular stuff that I'll mention is that, you know, coming into 2025, we do have enterprise organizations who are considering cellular first connectivity for their fleets of devices outside of cell phones. I don't know, Drew, if you remember this, but years ago, there was this wave. I think it was a big to-do at the Consumer Electronics Show.
Yeah, CES. Yep.
Yeah. So like 2018, 2019-ish, all of the different laptop vendors were doing this always on, always connected, cellular enabled platform thing. And it kind of fizzled out for a while, but I think that's circling back around because organizations see the benefit of that over traditional connectivity and just kind of having that always on component. So I think we're going to see more organizations moving towards cellular first platforms outside of just phones. And we're also, of course, still seeing organizations considering private cellular.
Yes.
Which is still built on the same technology and in private cellular architecture. So, you know, think of private cellular to be used the way you would use Wi-Fi, and that it's your stuff and your network. But there is also a neutral host network model whereby your private cellular infrastructure can service public cellular connections if you have that relationship and agreement with the network operators like Verizon, AT&T, et cetera.
Yeah, definitely seeing a lot of interest for private cellular in like manufacturing in particular, where instead of having to put up Wi-Fi APs in a huge space, potentially, you know, noisy or RF noisy environments, or even just frankly dirty environments, you can put out private cellular, throw some SIMs into the machines you need to connect, and it may be a little bit easier than getting, you know, Wi-Fi cards and stuff into things. All right, as we mentioned, links in the show notes if you want to dig in. JG, you had another quick story about mobility you wanted to touch before we move on.
Yeah, well, speaking of cellular vulnerabilities, there's not a lot to talk about with this right now, but I just thought this was really interesting. And that's that Vodafone in Europe has now created a technology whereby they can leverage satellite signals for cell phone calls with just standard cell phones. So instead of typical cellular operation, your phone, let's say user A, you're the caller, you're attached to some cellular tower near you that has, you know, various connectivity wired back to wherever the person you're calling is, person B. So you go, you know, cellular to some link to cellular. What this does is if you're out in a remote area and you don't have cellular service, which happens a lot of places for different reasons, right? Mm-hmm. You can actually use your regular phone to bounce off of a satellite connection that goes through then like an on-ground terrestrial, in this case, Vodafone satellite thing that then translates that to a typical, you know, cellular communication and then passes it through that normal network. So really interesting technology, interesting use case. I love this. I think there's going to be an additional layer of, you know, security conversation to be had around this later, but I love to see that this is where we're headed.
Yeah, for sure. And there's lots of folks working on this. I know Apple has made some announcements with some providers being able to get emergency satellite connectivity with a standard Apple phone, meaning you could send a text to emergency services, for instance. You're not going to be necessarily making calls or streaming videos. And I think T-Mobile recently announced the same capability with Starlink in select areas. So yeah, this is definitely coming and it is definitely going to be a thing.
Yeah.
Moving on, BeyondTrust recently was involved in an incident in which attackers were able to manipulate BeyondTrust's remote support SaaS service to get access to customers, including the U.S. Treasury Department. They have now released details of the attack. What's interesting to me is the chain of events. So I guess there was a zero day at an unnamed third-party application that BeyondTrust was using. The attackers used that zero day to gain access to a BeyondTrust AWS account, from which the attacker then got access to an API key that got them access to another BeyondTrust AWS account that hosts the remote support SaaS, and from there were able to get into the U.S. Treasury Department and others.
Yes. People, lock down your API keys. Make them specific for the use case and the access and rotate them regularly. Like, I know API keys are new-ish for us all, but anybody that's, you know, developing and managing cloud platforms, we really have to do a little bit better job here. I do want to say BeyondTrust, I am a bit of a BeyondTrust fan. I like a lot of their solutions and how they work as a network engineer. They've been very transparent through this, which I just love to see. I cringe when I see an organization with fantastic products that just kind of clamps up during an incident or a breach. And they've been very, very transparent and very sherry about this.
Yeah, I think it does highlight a couple of things, JJ, you mentioned. One, dealing with API keys, there are so many now concatenated services across particularly public cloud services, talking to services. Do you have good visibility into what's happening, these chains of communications and these chains of potential vulnerabilities? And then there's a supply chain issue here as well, where the actual access into BeyondTrust's infrastructure was via another third party with a zero day. So I feel like we're just seeing the risk field just expand and expand that security seems to have to deal with now.
Yep. And I think just to kind of put a little context around who did what here. So there was a hacker group tied to China. I don't know what level of sponsorship they had, but they were the ones who infiltrated, if we're just going to use that word, right? So they swung through all of these different infrastructures through the API keys, got into the Treasury Department. It's believed that they were targeting the Treasury's sanctions office system, so the computers within their sanctions office, because the Treasury had just made announcements about sanctions against Chinese firms in response to the Salt Typhoon attacks on telecoms, which of course we've covered a few times. So, you know, all the major telecoms here were breached in various ways throughout time by this threat actor group. So, you know, really interesting here. That is, I think, the definition of an advanced persistent threat and a nation state actor that's going to, you know, I'm kind of laughing about locking down API keys, but I do also sort of feel like they were going to find a way in, and this happened to be the way in.
Yeah, I mean, it's also, I think, clearly kind of a middle finger from the threat actors, like, yep, we got your telco networks and you sanction us, we'll go hit your sanctions office. We are unstoppable.
Yeah, and I don't know what they were going to do once they got there. I mean,
like, my assumption is the point was just to show you we can do it. Like, go ahead, yeah, sanction us, and then we'll just hack your systems. It was sort of
a little bit of a bullying tactic there.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Again, links in the show notes if you want to read up on it. We'll move on. A class action lawsuit has been filed against LinkedIn by premium customers. The suit's alleging that LinkedIn shared private messages from premium customers with third parties to use for the purposes of training AI models. The suit alleges that LinkedIn made policy changes about the sharing of customer data to kind of cover its tracks.
First of all, I have to ask, because the first headline I read said Microsoft's LinkedIn. Does Microsoft own LinkedIn? Am I that?
Oh, you're way behind, JJ. Yes.
Oh my God.
That happened a while ago.
I saw that and I was like, oh my God, does Microsoft own LinkedIn? Holy crap. All right. Well, I'm embarrassingly behind on that, apparently. But yeah, what was disturbing about this, and I float in and out of being a LinkedIn premium member, super expensive, but they took private messages to train the model. You know, it's one thing to kind of say, look, you're using our platform and things that you post, we're going to use. I don't love that. But I could at least expect it from a free platform. But when you start getting into people's private messages, that's just a little Slim Shady right there.
Absolutely. Like, I don't know what was in LinkedIn's heart, but this does seem kind of sneaky. And frankly, I think a lot of us have come to reconcile the fact that if you're using a service at the free tier, you know your data is essentially being shopped around other places. But if I'm paying for the service, I'm a premium customer, I would expect not to be exploited as part of that deal. I can understand, well, aside from the money, the motivation to, you know, smack LinkedIn a little bit about this.
Yeah, if it's free, you are the
product. But if I'm paying for it, hey, stop it.
Yeah, but premium is expensive. I think, you know, most recently it's like $80 a month, or maybe it's 100 and something. It's not a token. It's quite expensive. The article mentioned, and Reuters has a great write-up on this, that LinkedIn had quietly introduced a privacy setting last August that let users enable or disable the sharing of their personal data. Usually, when any of the companies sort of sneakily do this, like we saw Zoom, you know, and similar platforms over the past year or so kind of try to sneak in these things, usually somebody catches it, blows the whistle early, but this is just bubbling up now in the past couple of weeks here, end of January, and this was from last August. So it went several months without being noticed, apparently.
Yeah.
Oh, but if you're in the class action lawsuit, you will get a whopping $1,000.
Does that cover your premium account for a year? I don't know.
I don't know. I just unpremiumed myself a week or two ago. So maybe I was probably during that time. So we'll see.
Anyway, just a reminder to go check your settings and see what LinkedIn is and isn't sharing.
Yes. Maybe. Yeah. Yeah, let's share.
Before we move on, JJ, just since you weren't aware that Microsoft owned LinkedIn, did you know that Microsoft bought GitHub and Minecraft? Are you up on all this?
No, Minecraft is that game, right?
It's a game, yeah.
Okay.
And GitHub, you're aware?
Yes, I've at least heard that. The whole LinkedIn thing, I don't know if I heard it and I have repressed
that.
I do want to know about Minecraft, though, because I love like that kind of games. I'm not into like active shooter things. I get a little too aggressive with high action games, but I love, you know, like Angry Birds and Tetris and building things. I love building things. So I just wonder, is that a kid's game or is it fun for adults?
I mean, if you like building things, I mean, it's aimed at kids. My kids played it. They're older now. They don't play it as much as they used to. It's very much like digital Legos. And you have a little person and you can build the whole little landscape. You can even like make controls to do things automated. It's really fantastic. It's a great video game. As a parent, I was like, yes, go ahead, play Minecraft. That's fine.
I'm going to get in on that. Do you remember Lemmings?
I do not remember Lemmings.
You remember the Lemmings?
No.
No? Okay. Somebody listening remembers the Lemmings game, and I want you all to publicly chastise Drew on Twitter or whatever social media platform. We're on all of them.
Blue Sky. I'm off Twitter. Twitter's done.
Off Twitter. Okay. Blue Sky. What's your Blue Sky handle?
Drew CM.
Drew CM.
D-R-E-W and then CM.
And the CM stands for?
Conry Murray.
Just going to make up something stupid and I thought better of it. Okay, moving along. let's talk about not the other Starlink, but the Subaru Starlink.
Oh, is this a different thing?
Yeah, this is Subaru's version of OnStar that GMC has.
Okay, so I guess a couple of researchers have a report out demonstrating that there was a vulnerability in Subaru Starlink subsequently patched. This is a connected vehicle service that would let an attacker remotely manipulate any vehicle and exfiltrate data if they were given the owner's last name and either a zip code, email, address, phone number, or license plate.
Yes. Now, just before everybody panics, the researchers did this by looking up one of the developers for this on LinkedIn, getting his or her email address, and then taking over that account. But what they found was that when you get into that portal, so the Subaru Starlink, you know, employee, the backend portal, right? Not a user side.
Okay.
They could see and access and do pretty much whatever they wanted to and transfer that control to any other mobile device, like a phone app device, including unlocking, you know, the vehicle. But I think the scariest part of this is that they had full, very detailed location information on the vehicle. It's reported as from the past 12 months. However, the only reason it's 12 months for what they were doing is he was using his mom's Subaru, which she had only had for 12 months. So I think the assumption is very likely that they have much longer history. And he even noted in the write-up, we've got the links in the show notes, fantastic write-up, that like he could tell which doctor's appointment she went to, which friend she visited, and where she parked when she went to church. Like that's wow. The level of granularity.
Wow.
That they have access to. And it sounds like, so even though they've patched this whole, from what the researchers did, there's this other privacy conversation to be had here, because it sounds like almost any employee could still view that and back for, you know, potentially as long as you own the vehicle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we on Network Break had talked recently about the FTC settling a lawsuit with General Motors over their OnStar service. General Motors was apparently sharing sensitive data, including location, driving speed, all that, with third parties, which was then being shared to like credit reporting agencies. So your car is essentially now a data collection and surveillance mechanism. And yes, these kind of OnStar things, they also have a safety component, but there's definitely a data collection component, surveillance component to them. And we as a consumer society really need to reconcile with this trade-off between safety and privacy.
I mean, this is about Subaru, this particular article. I don't want to just pick on Subaru. It's all of them.
Yeah.
There's a long list of, you know, companies that have been already found to kind of overshare and create privacy issues. There's a long list of vulnerabilities in those platforms that have already been released the past few years. So it is really disturbing. And I think, you know, Subaru's answer of, oh, well, we use location data for, you know, emergencies. Well, you don't need, you know, data from a year or two ago about where the car was in order to facilitate emergency services for an incident that's happening now. And you don't need to make that available to all of the employees. I mean, I don't know if it's all, but even a large subset, like you just don't need to do that.
Right.
Zero trust this stuff, people.
What's also disturbing is, frankly, like obviously being able to get access to this data is scary, but the fact that they were able to compromise this employee admin portal and even get around some two-factor authentication mechanisms is also scary. Yeah. I don't know what this means for the rest of Subaru's IT infrastructure.
Yeah. You know, when I see people bypassing multi-factor, I didn't dig into that aspect of it, but there are so many ways to bypass multi-factor, because if you have access to the email account, then there's a self-help portal or a password reset, or you can use that to temporarily disable multi-factor. Sometimes there are one-time strings. Uh-huh. I don't want to call them passwords. They're really long, like they're 20 and 30 some digits long, that are meant to be like a break glass use in case of emergency if you're locked out. But those do not require multi-factor if you're having to use a recovery code.
Okay. And that might be in somebody's email and you just find that and then presto.
Yeah, you could. I mean, it depends on how they have access to that. Typically, the platform presents that to you one time. Mm-hmm. And you have to copy, save it, whatever. Putting that in a password vault, of course, is ideal. I'm not saying this is what happened, but people do other things like save them in notes. I know like in Outlook, I have, you know, note. I don't have passwords in notes, but you can make little notes in your email platform, or people email things to themselves. So
yes.
Who knows?
Right.
But there's lots of ways to bypass multi-factor.
Yeah. So much scary stuff today. Moving on, JJ, you found a story about NATO actually responding to reports of somebody messing with an undersea cable.
Yeah, this has been happening more frequently recently. I can't remember if we covered this in the last news roundup. I think we did. So long story short, there's actually four different stories sort of rolled up in the past few weeks, which is that another Baltic Sea data cable was damaged. NATO then decided to put a task force together to sort of protect that sea space from these, what are not really accidents. You know, the people doing them are claiming it's an accident, but they have some situations where they found suspicious crafts dragging anchors for hundreds of nautical miles. Like, sorry. When you're captaining a ship, you know if the freaking anchor is down and dragging on the bottom of the floor.
And if not, you shouldn't be captain.
Yeah, it's a little bit disturbing. So, you know, there's some rumblings about Russia around this. There's also been some rumblings around, you know, China, because I think most recently one of the ships that they seized that was doing some sneaky, weird, suspicious things was from a Chinese-owned organization that launched out of Hong Kong. It gets really twisty trying to figure out who owns what, you know, because in maritime, you know, there's so many parties involved and, you know, who's doing something, moving something, paying something, contracted to something. It's not just one entity.
Yeah.
So the most recent one was the Vezhen, not to be confused with my company name, which is Vision, but the Vezhen. So that was sailing under a Malta flag. But anyway, NATO has put together this task force. They're actually doing some pretty cool stuff with AI. And I think in the show notes, you'll see a link to a CNN article. I think they actually like really went out. They've got video, they've got photos. They really took a deep dive into this coordinated effort. So they're using like ships, they're using air drones and underwater sea drones, and they're using AI, all kinds of cool stuff. But long story short is there's estimates that 95 to 90% of the world's internet traffic runs through these various undersea cables. And they're just out there, right? They're just out there in the middle of the sea. And it's been kind of challenging because, you know, laws about where in the maritime world, when you're in certain regions, you're kind of like not under anybody's law. So I'm happy to see NATO doing something here. And they've had, you know, I think three of these incidents of cut or sabotaged cables just in the past few weeks.
Yeah, so I guess this alliance is called Baltic Sentry. So it is a NATO effort. So they'll use things like warships, F-35 stealth fighters to respond to reports of potential or suspicious activity with undersea cables, they say, within half an hour to an hour.
Yeah.
So links in the show notes, we'll move on. The Trump administration has ordered the Cyber Safety Review Board, or CSRB, to disband. Created in 2022 under the Biden administration, the CSRB brought together cybersecurity leads at multiple federal agencies and private sector experts to review significant security incidents and make recommendations. And the goal was to improve security in both the public and private sectors. Because it was created by executive order, it can also be disbanded the same way. I looked up the CSRB during its brief tenure. They released reports on the Log4j vulnerabilities, the Lapsus threat group in a 2023 intrusion of Microsoft Exchange. And at present, those reports are still available if you're interested, and we'll have the link in the show notes. But it does look like the new administration has some thoughts about cybersecurity.
Yeah, this was a little disturbing to me. Yeah, I think those of us that work in the security community, we really like the work that the CSRB has been doing. And it is comprised of individuals from industry. It's not just government figureheads who are appointed to this board to look into and run investigations. It's been compared to the Transportation Safety Board.
Like after an airline crash when they get together and do a review.
Yeah. There's a lot of value. And when they looked at Microsoft, when you saw all the kind of scathing reports, some of those against Microsoft came from the CSRB in their investigation. They really like dive into this, into these incidents to understand what happened, what were the lapses, you know, who needs to be held responsible, but also what do organizations need to do. And I think it was fantastic because we don't have a lot of control with supply chain. We have a lot of risk associated with that. And this was a fantastic way to just kind of have a neutral third party look at everything and have some, you know, accountability in just at least exposing what happened and forcing the organizations to share at least some of that information so that there could be lessons learned and we could do a better job the next time, and to just kind of come in swinging. And now I'm a huge fan of like smaller government, not to be political. I'm unaffiliated because they all crazy, but just to kind of come in swinging and just make these broad sweeping, you know, just dismiss and disband and remove all of these groups is a little bit disturbing to me, especially when, you know, CISA has been for years now doing such fantastic work. And we rely so heavily on the information that they put out. You know, I'm hoping this is a one-off and not a precursor to a broader stroke and a swipe to remove some of, you know, what CISA and other groups have been doing. But I guess we'll just have to wait and see.
Yeah, it's particularly disturbing in light of the fact of the, you know, SALT typhoon attacks against American infrastructure by essentially foreign state actors. This is precisely the kind of thing that the CSRB would be great to investigate and put out publicly available information about.
And they were in the middle of that. That's what they were doing when they were disbanded. They weren't even allowed to finish that work. Which is, yeah, I should have mentioned that. Why waste all of that effort, right?
Right.
And we're talking about other countries attacking us. There have been looks from the U.S. government into Chinese Communist Party and their activities, as well as Russia. And I think there's huge value in that for us because we're staring down the barrel a little bit with Russia, Ukraine, China, Taiwan, and we are squarely in the crosshairs of both of those entities. So I don't like that we've lost this resource, but I'm hoping there's some silver lining here and we get something else.
Yeah, we'll see. Again, link in the show notes if you want to go grab those reports while you can. It is good stuff. We'll move on. You may remember the Change Healthcare ransomware attack from last year. Health information of more than 100 million people was stolen. The attack crippled the ability of hospitals and other healthcare providers to bill for services. It essentially impacted healthcare delivery for months. TechCrunch is reporting that Change Healthcare used a sneaky trick to hide its data breach notice on its website. TechCrunch looked at the HTML of the breach notification page and found a no index setting. So it's essentially telling search engines not to include that page in search results. TechCrunch said it contacted Change Healthcare about the no index setting, but did not get a response to that question. Maybe it wasn't done on purpose. Maybe it was just an accident, a mistake. If it wasn't an accident or a mistake, it's a really petty, sneaky move. And JJ and I were talking about this, you know, before the show, like, it's not like it wasn't already public. People knew about it. And these breach notifications are required either by state or federal law anyway, but throwing a no index in there just seems like a little bit of a middle finger.
Yeah. And again, everybody knew this is going on. This is huge. So it wasn't like they could have really been hiding something.
Yeah. They weren't doing any message control or anything.
Yeah. I have to wonder if it was, well, if it was a mistake, you know, or something like whatever process or platform they have by default sets pages into index unless they're determined to be, you know, public.
Sure.
or searchable, crawlable, whatever.
Right.
Because, you know, what we were talking about just right before we hopped on here was most organizations do want to control the narrative. If something bad has happened that involves them, they want you to have that information from them mm-hmm. versus from somebody else. Mm-hmm. So when we were talking about even just Beyond Trust in this segment, you know, Beyond Trust even sponsors the page that has their breach incident and research notification information on it. So they're paying to get it up there first so that you can easily find that.
You mean they're paying like Google to get that their link surfaced above everything else if you're looking for the Beyond Trust incident notification? Okay.
And I think that's common for a lot of organizations. And again, I think they were, you know, super transparent. So not that I would have expected Change Healthcare to pay to sponsor that, but it does just kind of make me wonder if the no index was just a boo-boo somewhere along the way or an oversight. But I would have expected them at this point, them being Change Healthcare, to have issued a statement and at least answered and said, oh, you know, here's what happened. So the fact that they haven't done that feels a little creepy.
Yeah.
They had originally said it was more than 100 million people. We think that count is up to 190 million. And just for context, that's 190 million people impacted by this one breach. Mm-hmm. There's 210 million registered voters here in the United States, and we're estimated to have a population around 340 million. So you're talking about more than half of the U.S. population.
Oof.
All because somebody didn't have multi-factor set up on a Citrix server.
Wow.
$3 billion we're at so far with this.
Jeez.
Billion, like with the little where you do the pinky thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
link in the show notes if you want to go get mad about it.
Okay.
And now we're going to do kind of a speed run through a variety of things you should be patching if you have this infrastructure in place. First, research team Black Lotus Labs has released research about malware on Juniper routers. These are edge routers often acting as enterprise VPN gateways. The malware monitors TCP traffic for so-called magic packets. If these packets have the right parameters, including a challenge response sequence, the malware then opens a reverse shell that an attacker can use to access the gateway to control device and then do things like steal data or install additional malware. The researchers say this attack was active between 2023 and 2024. It's not clear if this is still ongoing or something that Juniper has addressed, but it is out there in the wind.
Yeah, and we have lots of links in here for you guys. And I think we'll probably need to follow up with like a mention next week or maybe a blog post. Are we still doing blog posts? Maybe we'll do a blog post.
We do have a blog at packetpushers.net.
Because I can't yet find an actual post from Juniper on this. And they're usually pretty good about, you know, their piece or, you know, providing information. So I'm missing something or something else is happening. I don't know. So I don't really even understand the scope of this. So some of the news headlines specifically reference Juniper routers. Other news headlines reference Juniper VPN devices. Some of the research out of Lumen's Black Lotus Labs says half of them are Juniper routers serving as VPN gateways. So I can't tell if it's anything running Junos or if it's some subset of those, because there were also subsets of devices that were compromised through NetConf. Yeah, I don't know the scope of this yet, but it's a little bit twisty. I think they don't even know how that initial entry is happening.
Right. The report sort of starts with the premise that these edge routers had this malware on it and it's using magic packets to do X, Y, Z. And you're like, but wait, how did the malware get there? We're skipping a step.
So we're not sure how. Now I'm going to kind of work backwards from this, because what they did say is the exact end goals of the campaign are unknown, but Black Lotus Labs told Hacker News, which is one of the links we have in here, it's interesting targeting that aligned with the strategic goals for a certain country known for intellectual property theft, China, specifically aimed at the microprocessor manufacturing and shipbuilding verticals. So in their write-up at the Lumen blog, you'll see like a really interesting breakdown of the targeted industries and what they saw where. But this whole like magic packet thing, they're in part leveraging some vulnerabilities that are, you know, 20 years old, but they're using this system to make sure that only they, the attackers, are able to control this malware once it's installed. And so there's this kind of challenge response thing as an authentication, making sure that the commands are coming from the attackers who put it there instead of some other organization or entity that might be using their malware.
Whoever got this malware on the device doesn't want anybody else playing with it.
Yeah. And they're calling it J-Magic, which of course I love.
Yeah, Black Lotus is calling it J-Magic.
Yeah, they found it. So remember, though, that a lot of the world's internet runs on Juniper routers. And a lot of organizations have Juniper routers and firewalls and Junos devices at their edge. They're doing VPN, they're doing firewall-y thingies. So again, I don't know the scope of this. It does seem like it was targeted. So if you go check out the Lumen blog, you know, you'll kind of get an idea of this is not some widespread, everybody needs to freak out and do something, but it is a little bit concerning that they've strung together several attacks in this malware, and they're targeting these entities.
Yeah, the impression I got is this is not an attack aimed at like core telco routers. This was very targeted at specific entities using edge routers as VPN gateways. But if you're a journal or customer, maybe you want to go talk with a rep and see if they have any insight on what's happening and if you need to be worried about anything. Moving on, attackers are exploiting a zero-day vulnerability in Zycel CPE devices.
So Zycel is one of those, you know, really common brands that are used commonly in like CPE equipment in residential. So ISPs will put Zycel equipment out, MSPs will put Zycel equipment out, and this is just one of a long string of vulnerabilities targeted for, you know, consumer edge devices. We've seen and reported on several different pieces of malware floating around aimed at like IoT device takeovers and denial of service malware that's distributed. But this is a command injection vulnerability, so there's a CVE tied to it. So it allows an attacker to execute arbitrary commands on the device, which can lead to exfiltration of data, infiltration of computer network, or total system compromise.
Yeah, so one of the things that's tricky about this, you know, sort of third-party CPE is you might not know you actually have that in your house or in your office if it was put there by somebody else. So hopefully somebody's doing something.
So it says, as of right now, and this article came out January 29th, so it says that they're working through their disclosure process with Zycel and going to be sharing more details next week. So maybe by the next time we talk, we can again kind of have some updates on here, but this just kind of circles back around to we have to collectively do a little bit better job, not just protecting the enterprise things in front of all of our juicy stuff, but also all of this, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of devices out at the consumer edge.
Yeah. Moving on, SonicWall is warning of hackers that are exploiting a vulnerability in their SMA series appliances.
Yeah, I was looking into this, and I think the SMA, which is like Secure Mobile Access, is the updated or refreshed version of what used to be the SRA, which I'm pretty sure was the Avantail product. So Avantail made a lot of really high-end VPN solutions that, you know, back in the day, a lot of the financial organizations, you know, we worked with used. So super secured stuff, not just like throw it up and let everybody in to do everything. Meaning these devices are enterprise grade,
yep,
and probably actually pretty prevalent and still floating around out there, including critical infrastructure. So vulnerability in the SMA series appliances, which are used for remote access, you know, SSL VPN type of access. Definitely, if you have those floating around the environment, you need to check that out.
I think specifically it's the SMA 1000 series.
Yeah, I looked at the actual one of them. It listed other ones. So I would say if you have an SMA, check it out, period. And then maybe it's only impacting a subset of those. But I think one of the vulnerability disclosures I looked at listed several other models.
Yeah. Moving on, apparently a research organization, the Shadow Server Foundation, is saying that nearly 50,000 Fortinet firewalls are vulnerable to a zero-day. Fortinet has issued a patch for the zero-day, but there are still many unpatched devices out there that attackers are apparently taking advantage of.
Yeah. I don't know if we're not doing a good job of communicating these vulnerabilities to the right people that need to manage and maintain these devices. So Shadow Server Foundation's, you know, monitoring this because these are internet facing. So they said the breakdown is something like, you know, 20,000-ish of them found in Asia. And when I say of them, specifically vulnerable to the zero day that we're talking about here, yeah, with a CVE attached to it. So just shy of half of them in Asia, North America, around 13,000, Europe, about 7,500. So these things are still out there and floating. This is in the KEV catalog now because it is a known exploited vulnerability. So remembering that we have differences, a CVE is just a vulnerability. A KEV is a known exploited vulnerability. That is the, like, no crap, patch it now, yesterday, immediately, if not sooner, as my grandfather would say.
Yeah. And as I mentioned, there is a patch available for this. So it's not like Fortinet has dragged its feet. It's got the software update out there. Yeah. Yes, patching is hard. Updating is hard. You always risk problems when you have to take a device out of service, upgrade it, and put it back in and hope it still functions. But when there is an active exploit happening, that should be a priority. And last but not least, Avanti back in the news.
Poor Avanti.
Yeah, but I guess there are multiple pull attacks, chaining attacks together, attacking Avanti gear.
Yeah. And we've been hearing about Avanti for, I don't know, 9 months, 10 months, a year now with these various zero days and vulnerabilities. I tend to be a little harsher with some of this because I think Avanti is, you know, one of the sets of portfolios within one of the companies that just kind of gobbles up older stuff and then does the bare minimum to keep that product alive so that they can get, you know, the renewals for the services and support, but they don't put a lot of effort or money into research and development, into security patching, et cetera. So when the first, you know, Avanti vulnerability came out, I think, well, okay, I'm going to speak for myself. I'm not going to speak for Drew, but JJ's personal opinion was don't necessarily just patch that, but pull that out and put something a little bit better in because of what these things do and that they are, you know, on the border facing the internet for remote access. So now, again, end of January, coming into February, we're talking about this has been ongoing with now new attacks chained together for over a year. So, you know, I think it's time for organizations to take a, if you've got this in your environment, take a hard look at what this company is or is not doing to protect you and then make some decisions if you need to, because this is highly disruptive.
Yeah, for sure. Obviously, Avanti would say, well, look at any cybersecurity vendor. Nobody has a perfect record. And that is absolutely true. But one of the things you want to be looking at is how well does the vendor respond when a vulnerability is found, when an active exploit is happening? How good are they at helping you, you know, get software out there, find workarounds and so on to address the issues? That's one of the criteria you should be investigating.
And maybe I'm missing it, so I don't want to be too, you know, rude here, but, you know, I didn't see any big response from them during all of their other 0 days that they've had. You know, I would have expected, oh, okay, here's how we're changing our process. Here's how we're doing QA. Here's how we're doing security testing, whatever. But they're just now, after like a year of this, saying they're going to be looking at their internal processes for this type of product management. So that does not give me warm and fuzzy feelings at all. So we're always interested, you guys listening, in kind of the topics. We do have some topics that you guys have submitted through the form and or in the Slack channel that we're going to be looking at. But I think we have some opportunity to kind of dig more into these undersea cable stuff, because I think that's fun and cool. So maybe that's going to be one of our topics coming up.
Yeah, we're going to make that happen. We're going to be talking to Ed Harmouche again about ACME. That'll be coming up. Ed did a show with us on some interesting ways to protect your certificate infrastructure. And then we're going to have some CISO conversations coming up and more interesting things. So we hope we have piqued your interest about new shows coming up on Packet Protector.
Yeah. Oh, and another Chris Greer.
Chris Greer is coming back too. We just released an episode with him on Wireshark. We're going to be talking about Nmap. He's got some interesting things to say about Nmap and what you need to know about that. So yeah, Chris Greer is coming back too. So lots of good conversations to look forward to. In the meantime, thank you for joining us for this episode of Packet Protector. As JJ mentioned, if you have a topic you want us to cover, you can find both of us on LinkedIn. We also have packetpushers.net/community. You can join our free Slack channel and talk to other IT and security pros along with JJ and I. And as always, if you have a comment, you have a correction, you have a question, you can send us follow-up at packetpushers.net/FU. We do love it when listeners reach out, and we do take every communication seriously. So if you have something to say, let us know. As always, make sure you're eating your security vegetables.